This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Israel's do-over election has ended in a dead heat between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and this man.
אפשר לומר שלפי התוצאות המסתמנות, נתניהו לא הצליח במשימתו.
Benny Gantz spoke to a crowd of supporters early this morning, saying Netanyahu did not succeed in achieving a solid right-wing victory. Does Netanyahu's failure to gain more seats in this election mean his days as prime minister are numbered? We'll see over the next few weeks as Israel's political parties try to build a governing coalition among yesterday's winning factions. Netanyahu will be fighting not only for his political future, but also for his freedom. He's facing corruption charges. Winning another term as prime minister might be the only way for him to avoid prosecution. What do the election results mean for Israel's future? And how would another term for Netanyahu affect any future peace process in the Middle East, especially one that involves the U.S.? Joining us now to help unpack yesterday's election is Ryan Chilcote, a special correspondent with the PBS NewsHour. He's on the Israeli side of the Gaza border right now in Nahaloz, and he's been in Israel for the past week speaking with voters. Ryan, welcome to 1A.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Also joining our conversation is David Makovsky, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also co-author of the new book, Be Strong and of Good Courage, How Israel's Most Important Leaders Shaped Its Destiny. David, welcome.
Delighted to be with you.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about Israel's election or what it means for the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Perhaps you've been watching that election very closely and had certain outcomes that you were hoping for or worried about. In any case, we'd love to hear from you. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Ryan Chilcote, let me start with you. Set the scene for us today in Israel, one day after this election. It's evening now in Israel. What's the mood like?
Well, you know, the mood is a bit reserved, you know, because this election really leaves everyone where they were 5 months ago with the first election, in the sense that there's no clear answer to the question of who's going to be prime minister, what happens to Netanyahu, and what parties are going to be in the governing coalition. So I think a lot of people are a little bit have resolved themselves to now waiting, because we're in a waiting game while the parties sorted out amongst themselves, and one of them tries to build a coalition to get the magic number of 61 seats to form a government, something that Netanyahu couldn't do 5 months ago.
Yeah, David Makovsky, that was exactly what I was going to ask you to clarify just a little bit more with regard to the parliamentary system. That's kind of the crux of this, is that, you know, Israelis weren't voting directly for prime minister. They were voting to try to create a kind of leadership that would build the coalition, right?
That's correct. Israel's a parliamentary system, 120 members in its parliament, the Knesset. You need a bare majority, 61. Netanyahu reached 60, cobbling together in the spring after that election. He fell one short. But what's different this time, I think, is that it seems clear that his role of exclusive control of Israel, he's dominated the country for 10 years. He's always been able to get over 61. Now he doesn't have that option. And that seems to put us all who watch this into looking at some sort of a power sharing arrangement. And the question is, does he lead that? Is he part of it or is he not? So I think the options are fewer this time, and this is probably the lowest moment for him in these 10 years. He's, when you add the period in the 90s when he was prime minister, he's the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history, recently eclipsing its founder, David Ben-Gurion. This is probably his lowest moment.
And just to be clear, that magic number 61, is that to have just a plurality or the majority in Israel?
That's Israel's the bare majority, 61 out of 120. Yeah.
Ryan, you spoke with some Israeli voters yesterday on Election Day. Here's a little bit of what they told you.
I vote for Gantz because it needs to be a change, because Netanyahu is doing very bad things for everybody. I don't agree what he's doing, and
if you ask me, the Arabs not accept us. No, only to throw us to the ocean. That's it. So, also, the Israeli Arabs.
So Netanyahu is the solution?
Yeah, only Netanyahu. I don't care about his wife, about his children, about if he took cigarette or not. I don't care.
Now, Ryan, that first voter said she usually votes for Netanyahu's party, the Likud party, but in this election, she voted for the challenger, Benny Gantz. What does that mean in terms of split support between the party and its leader?
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why we saw Netanyahu's hand, politically speaking, weaken a bit. She loves Netanyahu. She's not alone. On the right, he's wildly popular. He's clearly the most popular politician in the country still. But she believes the allegations of corruption against him. And she thinks that because of that, he shouldn't be prime minister. So she's going to vote for Benny Gantz, who used to be an ally of the prime minister. And she says when Netanyahu goes away, then she'll continue her support for the Likud party. Whereas the second gentleman I spoke with said he believes the corruption allegations, but he doesn't care because Netanyahu, at the end of the day, is the candidate that is going to deliver on that tough line on the Palestinians, on the Arabs around Israel that he wants. And that's far more important to him. That trumps everything when it comes to who he chooses as prime minister and the man to lead this country. It's a really interesting dilemma. If you look at the a recent poll, about half of Israelis that were polled said that they believe the court system when it said that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu needs to be investigated and possibly indicted for on these corruption allegations. A third of the people in Israel believe that, in fact, Netanyahu, who's saying that it's just the courts out to get him, is correct. So some people are still trying to make up their mind about the allegations, and some people have already made up their mind, and then vote accordingly. And in some cases, even if they believe them, they're going to go for Netanyahu just because he's their man.
And Ryan, briefly remind us what those allegations are.
Yeah, well, he's facing three indictments for breach of trust and corruption, bribery. In the case of the bribery, it involves, in one case, taking expensive cigars and champagne from a supporter for political favor. And in 2 weeks exactly from today, there's going to be a hearing here in Israel where a judge will decide whether those indictments should go forward. If they do, he'll then go to trial. And if he's convicted, he could very likely go to prison.
David, I wonder what your assessment is with regards to those corruption charges. Brian from New Hampshire emailed, "Am I the only one who's bothered that whether in Israel, the U.S., or anywhere else, getting elected to the highest office in the land is a way to avoid the criminal justice system?" David, what about that dichotomy between the more kind of transactional relationship in terms of getting what voters want and the moral, ethical aspect of whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu committed crimes?
No, you raise an important point, and as did Ryan. I mean, you have a situation where half of the country, basically, led by the blue-white opposition, says this idea of their prime minister under legal cloud is so profound that they will not even entertain joining a power-sharing arrangement with him. And then you have the other half of the country who says, look, this is a harsh and unforgiving Middle East where there's a lot of militancy. There's a Syrian civil war on Israel's northern border. 500,000 people have been killed. There's Hamas on Gaza's border firing rockets, and Hamas doesn't accept Israel the size of a telephone booth on a Tel Aviv beach. And there's Hezbollah in Lebanon that also has 140,000 rockets. Given the hierarchy of issues, Netanyahu has kept the country safe. And that's why the center-left has been somewhat gingerly when it comes to Netanyahu's record because Gantz, by the way, was his chief of staff, the head of the military, where they'll say, look, the man has done a lot of good things. But if Israel is to survive, it's not just about interest. It's also about values. And Israel needs to hold itself to the most exacting Western standards and not make compromises, no discounts in this regard. So there's a real tension between these two sides of the platform. What do you prioritize?
David, what about the results now compared to April? They seem like they're not that much different. And granted, we're waiting for the final counts. But I wonder what your takeaways are in terms of the ability to build a governing coalition or not, including how this group called the Joint List, which is made up predominantly of Arab parties, how they fared in the election.
Yes. Look, I think what's clear, what makes this different than the April round is that, Netanyahu, first of all, lost ground. Without boring your listeners with all the inside baseball, essentially there were seven seats that he didn't, that he didn't fare where he did in April. And I think it's part of the fact that if you use the sports analogy, the Israeli public likes to be more around the 50-yard line. And I think they felt that because of his corruption allegations, he indebted himself so much to the harder right wing that he subordinated the national interest to his personal interest. And they just feel this is such a talented person. He's done great things for Israel's security. Israel's high-tech economy is such that its GDP per capita has just surpassed Japan. So there is a recognition of his achievements. But the public says, but you don't erode the democratic institutions of the country, the courts, the law enforcement, the parliament, using it to insulate yourself from legal proceedings. There's certain institutions this country is very proud of building over 70 years. And there's a sense that in the name of political survival, everything was allowed. And that gets to your question about the joint list. And here, I think Netanyahu really's strategy during the campaign towards the end really just blew up in his face. He charged that there was some forgeries, unsubstantiated, by the way, in the Arab sector. So he wanted partisans to be able to stand at polling booths with cameras. And he even wanted to enact emergency legislation to facilitate that.
Right.
And the public said that's too far, and it's hurting the fabric of Israeli life, and Arab voting turnout seems to have gone up from 10 seats to 12, 13. We'll see the final count if it's 12 or 13. But it was clearly a boost in turnout, and that is attributed to Netanyahu himself.
We got to pause in just a second. We'll get back to this conversation momentarily. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing yesterday's election in Israel and the future of the Middle East peace process with Ryan Chilcote, special correspondent with the PBS NewsHour, and David Makovsky, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, your thoughts on the Middle East peace process, what this election means, what it means to you, the future of Israel, the future of that relationship between the U.S. and Israel as it relates to the Middle East. So comment on our Facebook page. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Ryan, you spoke with some Arab voters yesterday during the election. Here is what a young Israeli Arab woman told you just outside Tel Aviv.
They're not changing anything through voting. That's why they're not voting. And I think it's wrong, because the more we vote, the more we change something, the more we affect our future. But it's like a lot of people who are not voting, there's a lot of things that are going against Arabs in Israel, okay?
Ryan, tell us a bit about that woman and what that said to you in terms of turnout.
Yeah, so her name is Saba Taha, and we spoke in the town of Kfar Qasim, which is just outside of Tel Aviv. Really interesting. Israel has Arabs. About a sixth of the electorate is actually made up of Arabs. And generally speaking, they don't vote because many of them are a little bit dismissive of the political establishment. They don't really think that their vote is going to make a change. In the past, there have been some predominantly Arab parties that tried to sort of exert their influence in the parliament, not so successfully. This time they got together in this group called the Joint List, and they went out and ran together. And, you know, the turnout, at least from as far as I could tell, looked pretty good. There were a lot of people there. One of the things that was interesting was there were also a lot of police. And that might have something to do with the fact that the prime minister directed the police to have a larger presence than usual at Arab polling stations, because he said, you know, they need to be on the lookout for fraud at Arab polling stations. A lot of people will tell you, and the woman I spoke with, that just meant to intimidate the Arabs and more than anything to really fire up Benjamin Netanyahu's support. So he said, look, you know, you need to go out. You Israeli Jews need to go out and vote, because the Arabs are going to be voting and they don't have your interests at heart. They're against us. Effectively is what he was saying. So, yeah, pretty decent turnout, and looks like they're going to get maybe 12 seats in the parliament. But I don't think that really makes him a power broker in Israel. It just is a reminder to other Israeli politicians that there are Arabs here and they should have a say in what happens in the country.
Well, David, who might the power brokers be? I mean, we've talked about Jewish voters, Arab voters turning out to the polls. Worth noting that there is a secular nationalist party called the Israel Beiteinu Party, and Avigdor Lieberman is commonly, you know, by many people's accounts, expected to be a major player in determining the shape of this future ruling coalition. Do you see it that way?
Look, Avigdor Lieberman in some ways is the winner of this election. He's a veteran politician who comes out of the former Soviet Union. He formed an immigrants party 30 years ago when the big post-Cold War immigrant wave brought over a million people from there to Israel. But 30 years afterwards, it's hard to be an immigrants party when the kids of these immigrants of 30 years ago feel Israeli. And he's tried to rebrand his party from being a more right-wing immigrants party to trying to be a unifying party that is avowedly secular. And he says the only thing he will allow is a power-sharing agreement. And he holds the balance of power. He's a kingmaker here. If it's a 56-55, Lieberman's 9 puts either side over. And he has disavowed the sense that he will go with either side. But he says, I've got to force the big ones together. And even if they leave me out of it, fine. The public loves this message of healing, of unity. And Lieberman has doubled his number of support just since April. So it's going to be a power sharing arrangement. I find it hard to believe that there could be a third round, that Netanyahu could subordinate the entire country to yet another round of elections. You know, writing this book, Be Strong and of Good Courage, profiling these four leaders of Israel who made historic decisions, they were not angels. They were politicians, too. But ultimately, when the national interest and the personal interest clashed, they chose the national interest. They put country first. And so I think that, to me, is the guiding idea. It was fascinating to write the book, but it's a guiding principle that the country wants to see healing. That has been something that Gantz, the leader of Blue White, has said. And the wrangling will go on for weeks, and there will be brinkmanship. Is Netanyahu going to be part of it? Is he even going to head it? But he's not going to be unbound the way he's been in the last several years, where he could just go with the right-wing group of ultra-Orthodox and settlers. And this is going to be also good news, in my view, for the U.S.-Israel relationship that could use bipartisanship and ensure that Israel is restored to the cause it's always been, which is a bipartisan issue and not be a partisan cause in this country.
Well, David, let me follow. Go ahead, Ryan. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, what David was saying there is just so correct. I spoke with voter after voter after voter that told me that they're fed up with the division that many of them said Netanyahu is pushing on the country. And, you know, that really resonated with me when you listen to the political discourse in the United States. I'd just been in the U.S. And it really does grab you. And Lieberman has caught, I think, people's attention for that reason. And to a certain extent, Benny Gantz, the leader of the Blue and White Party, because while he's, a lot of people will tell you, not very charismatic, you know, voters were telling me, he has, this Blue and White Party is kind of a big tent party, and he's reaching out to other coalition partners. And they say even when he's not a very good speaker, it's because he's a good listener. So that's a big theme here. And I think that's one of the reasons why Netanyahu didn't do as well as he did in April, because people are just sick of the division.
Let's shift gears now to the U.S.-Israel relationship. I want to talk about one of the campaign pledges that Benjamin Netanyahu made. But Ryan, first of all, just from your perspective, I know that it can get complex when we're looking at political affairs in Hong Kong and in South Korea and in Britain, yeah, and in the EU and in Brazil and Venezuela and Mexico and all over the world. Israel's election, what would you say to people who are, whose heads are just a little bit spinning, who get that the U.S. and Israel have a relationship, but this election might feel like minutiae? The folks who might say, call me back when the peace process restarts. Why should we in the U.S. be paying close attention to who wins this election?
Because they're likely going to be the United States partner when it comes to trying to forge some kind of peace in the Middle East. Now, a lot of people will tell you that that can go anywhere, but that the, whoever's the prime minister is going to be that partner. President Trump's about to announce his deal of the century, right? His peace plan for the Middle East. President Trump, voter after voter, has told me is the best friend that Israel has ever had. You know, he went to the Western Wall. He moved to the American embassy to Jerusalem. He recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights. They love him here, and they think that that peace plan is going to be to Israel's liking. The problem, of course, is that the Palestinians say that it's a non-starter. So even then, what does Israel do next is going to be decided by this prime minister. If the President Trump comes out with his peace plan and the Palestinians say it's a non-entity, it's really going to be up to that that prime minister to decide whether they just go ahead and push ahead and force whatever solution they want on the Palestinians, or whether they listen and maybe come to some kind of accommodations.
Well, and David, with regards to that process, I wonder where you see that, if indeed there is a process at this point. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu made a campaign pledge to annex the Jordan Valley, which is like a third of the West Bank. Now, the Trump administration has not directly condemned those plans to annex the Jordan Valley. I wonder what your sense is of the impact that would have, if it happened, on the U.S.-Israel relationship.
Look, I think it's becoming a theoretical issue at this point because Netanyahu doesn't have the, you know, the majority. There's going to have to be a power sharing arrangement. And you're putting your finger, you and Ryan, on a key point, which is the policies of a power sharing government is going to have to be, how do you preserve the option in the future? There's not going to be support on either side, I think, on the Israeli or Palestinian side for a grand deal. I worked for the last Secretary of State where we tried, but I don't see the Venn diagram of any on the Israeli and Palestinian side overlapping. But what I do see, and I think this is an important silver lining out of this stalemate and over this, and also the chance that I think is an important chance for healing the country that has been demoralized by the erosion of institutions, is what I do see is some sense that said, okay, let's keep the option open for a two-state solution.
Yeah.
And that means don't build outside the security barrier. That is 8% of the West Bank is where 87% of the settlers live near Israeli urban areas. You can have territorial exchanges that make a two-state solution possible. But Netanyahu's government was building outside that barrier in areas that would clearly be a Palestinian state. And I think what's going to happen now is you're going to see a limitation on that. You're going to see a pulling back. And in a strange way, the Trump peace plan here could be actually also a pivot point. I don't think the Trump peace plan is going to work. It's not going to be a basis for a great breakthrough, but it actually might be a pivot point for Netanyahu to move to the center and for Gantz, who said who wanted a government on his own, to move to the center. And the Trump plan will be more modest. Okay, we're not going to make peace between Israelis and Palestinians, but we're going to put down a marker, a historic reference point going forward. So I do think that we could see this Trump plan come out, not because I think the Palestinians will accept it. I don't think they will. But I think it's going to be part of a pulling back in Israel from these statements that you made about the Jordan Valley. If you annex 30% of the West Bank, what Palestinian is going to come to the table? But it's off the table now anyway, because that sort of government is not going to be formed. So I think everyone's pulling back from the brink. And I think that in itself is good news. There's a lot of wrangling ahead. There's going to be a lot of screaming and shouting for weeks. But yesterday was a dramatic, dramatic moment. Even though the headline might look stalemate, it's a new trajectory in Israel.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Ryan, I'd like you to answer a question from Aaron, who asked on our Facebook page, what are the odds that Netanyahu calls for new elections again in an attempt to keep voting until he gets the result he wants?
That's a good question. I think the odds are very low because I think Israelis wouldn't really accept that. Even if he could, and I don't know to be perfectly honest, the legal implications of that. Right now, the president will bring together the party leaders and say, who do you want to be prime minister? And then he will choose a leader of one party. It's probably going to be Benny Gantz. Maybe it'll be Benjamin Netanyahu. And he'll say, go out and try and form a coalition to form a government. The Israelis want to see a functional government. They do not want to go back to the polls. I think it's unprecedented to have two elections so close together. A third one, I think it's not going to happen.
Ryan, from the perspective of the Israelis that you have interacted with, is there really a peace process? There seems to be a lot of peace politicking. Donald Trump has said there's going to be a plan. Benjamin Netanyahu has had his rhetoric about it. But in terms of like a process, in terms of meetings that have agendas and then deliverables and then things that we can see that happen and those lead to new things. And then there are new agreements and people do things and they report on those things and then they adjust. The process, if it's there, I don't see it.
No, it's not here. And it was one of the things that struck me when I got here. The country is much further to the right. The political establishment is very unified in its stance on the Palestinians, and there's little room for accommodation. I will pick up on one thing that David said, though. I was just in Nahal Oz, which is a town right on the border, Israel's border with Gaza. It's not an international border. It's where Israel built a wall to separate them from the people, the Palestinians in Gaza, where 2 million people are basically crowded into a very small piece of land. And I was talking to a farmer whose land is right on the border. And he told me none of our leaders want to have peace now. And I don't think we as a people are ready for it, but we definitely have to have it someday. This is a guy who's standing in front of a wall that's, 10 meters high and get this 60 to 80 meters deep. Right. So that the Palestinians can't tunnel in Hamas can't tunnel into Israel. And he's saying this wall needs to be here now. But God forbid that this wall should be here for long, because I want my grandchildren to live in a country of peace where we don't have rocket attacks. And the only way for us to do that is start talking to the Palestinians. I was in the northernmost point of Israel a few days ago on the border with Lebanon. Exact same thing. Peace. We don't see it on the cards now. But someday we have to have it, just like we had it, just like we won it with Egypt. This country won't be totally at peace until we get to the table.
David, as we're winding down, I wonder what you see as the next steps for this process, for this peace process. I'm glad Ryan mentioned Egypt and Israel. We know how that ended. And with regards to the way things stand now, Ryan's saying that people felt like none of the leaders really want the peace process to move. Then what moves it forward?
No, this idea of not expanding settlements outside of the security barrier is crucial. It might seem tactical to some of your listeners, but frankly, it is indispensable, because if you preclude your options now, you don't have your options for a two-state situation down the road along the lines of the farmer in Nahal Oz or anybody else like that.
Yeah.
So you have to put down certain markers now that says you're not going to add new people to the West Bank, and you leave your options open. In my view, that is important, and that's a signal that will be heard on both sides, that because people don't believe anymore what is said. They'll believe what is done. And what is done here is to say, I'm not expanding settlements into the West Bank. You're going to also make maybe demands on the Palestinian side. Don't give money to relatives of suicide bombers to blow people up. The publics will hear the signals. They won't believe what the politicians say. They'll believe what they do. And if they take actions, which could be politically difficult on each side, in my view, it'll rebuild the constituency and end this profound sense of disbelief that any peace is possible. Mm-hmm. And so in my view, don't disregard. If you can't hit the home run ball, hit the solid single. The public will respond to that.
And Ryan, what are the next steps in this process we should be keeping an eye out for before we go?
Well, can the leaders of the two biggest parties, can the kingmaker, Avigdor Lieberman, that David was mentioning, can they form a government? The president's going to sit down with the leaders of the parties. He's got 6 days now left to do that. And then he will give one of those leaders an opportunity to form a national unity government. And boy, they better, or to form a coalition, to form a government. And boy, they better pull it off, because, 5-6 months of political stalemate is more than the Israelis appreciated, and they're ready to move on.
Ryan Chilcote, special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Ryan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And David Makovsky, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His new book is called Be Strong and of Good Courage, How Israel's Most Important Leaders Shaped Its Destiny. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we continue our series Foresight 2020, our conversations with Democratic presidential candidates. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar joins us to answer your questions next. Stay close.